Chapter 54. Murderous Millionaires. It was, oddly enough, a respectable English statesman, Lord Acton, who made the cynical comment, "All power tends to corrupt, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely." The sentiment sounds so revolutionary that many anarchists to this day believe that it was said by Bakunin, or by some other rabid anti-authoritarian. But is it really true? Fortunately, from the point of view of the criminologist, no. If it were, the rich and powerful of the world would all be supercriminals. There have been plenty of corrupt tyrants in world history, from Tiberius to Hitler and Stalin, but most of them have had more than a touch of insanity about their makeup. Moreover, what Europeans take for horrible cruelty may be just a kind of barbaric indifference to life. A typical example of Eastern cruelty can be found in Seven Pillars of Wisdom by Lawrence of Arabia. He describes how the Turkish army retook a certain town from the Bulgarians. All the peasants had fled, so there was no one for the commander-in-chief, Enver Pasha, to torment. Finally, someone found a very old man. After baiting him for a while, Enver ordered that he should be tossed into the ship's furnace. The old man screamed, but the officers were stronger, and the door was slammed shut on his jerking body. We turned, feeling sick, to go away, but Enver, his head on one side, listening, halted us. So we listened, until there came a crash within the furnace. He smiled and nodded, saying, "Their heads always pop like that." By Western standards, Enver was an evil sadist, but are we being accurate when we call him that? The French smuggler Henri de Montfried, in his classic autobiography Hashish, tells of a friend of his who could not resist shooting cats. When he saw a cat dozing in the sun, his rifle went up, there was a crash, and that cat usually dragged itself away to die. Yet Montfried's friend was a compassionate, kindly man, who often went to great lengths to help sick Africans and Arabs. How do we explain this paradox? Quite simply, Montfried's friend plainly did not regard cats as fellow creatures. What of some of those great tyrants of history, for example, Caligula, Nero? Are they not evidence of the corrupting influence of power? Well, it's obviously true that being the absolute ruler of the Roman Empire turned them into monsters of capricious cruelty. But anyone who's ploughed through the sickening pages of Suetonius's Lives of the Caesars will agree that there are hundreds, perhaps thousands, of potential Caligulas walking the streets of our major cities, and that most of them were born that way. By way of example, we may cite the appalling case of Georges Rapin, the rich playboy who chose to be a pimp and a murderer. Rapin, a suave and rather good-looking young man, was the son of a wealthy engineer. His great compulsion was to be admired and respected. So at school he spent more of his time boasting and passing around cigarettes than working for his baccalaureate. He left school in his early teens, unregretted by his teachers. During the next few years his father tried gently to propel him in the direction of various careers. Georges resisted this firmly until his father gave up the struggle. By the age of 18, in 1962, he was known as a man about town, driving his sports convertible and hanging around the dives and night spots of Pigalle and Montmartre until the first light of dawn. He also committed burglaries for the fun of it, and in 1964 he was arrested. Once again, his father's money allowed him to avoid the consequences of his own actions. The victim of the burglary was reimbursed, and the case was dropped. As a kind of penance, Georges entered the army. But his instability was now so obvious that he was soon thrown out again on the grounds that he was asocial and undesirable. His parents offered to finance him in business, and he chose to run two bars, but he did this so casually that they were soon bankrupt. His parents now persuaded him to try a career of their choice, and they made him the proprietor of a bookshop. That only convinced him that the thing he detested most in the world was literature. By this time, he knew what he wanted to be, a tough guy, or, as the French say, a cadre. He had a wide circle of acquaintances in the Parisian underworld. They knew him as Bill, a name he preferred. One night, in a bar named the Sans Souci, Bill met an 18-year-old prostitute, known simply as Dominique. She came from a village near Reims, and had been brought to Paris by a Corsican. When her lover and pimp ran into trouble through his blue movie interests, Dominique was taken over by Georges Rapin, who liked to think of himself as Bill the Kid. He had no real need to become a pimp. He had an adequate allowance from his father, but a real Kid manages girls and lives off their earnings. Dominique, however, proved to be more trouble than she was worth. It was true that her good looks brought many clients, but she was passionately devoted to gambling and to slot machines. Georges beat her up on several occasions, but it seemed to do no good. And then one day she told him that she was getting tired of working as a prostitute and she wanted to retire, perhaps get married and have a family. Georges was outraged. In the Parisian underworld, this was unheard of. A prostitute who tried to desert her protector would be scarred so badly that she would be marked for life as a woman of the streets. And Georges had built himself up a reputation as a ruthless thug. He later claimed that he had committed a dozen murders in the 18 months before Dominique's. One evening in 1969, Georges drove Dominique towards Fontainebleau in the back of his black Dauphin Gordini. She believed that they were on their way to commit a robbery. Georges had told her that she could buy her freedom for 500,000 francs, and she was hoping to obtain this from a single night's work. They stopped in a lonely place. Georges produced his revolver and said, "This is it." And as the girl started to get out of the car, he shot her down. As she lay groaning on the road, he stood over her, emptied an oil can onto her, and then set her on fire. And then he turned the car and drove back to Paris, leaving the girl writhing in the flames. The body was found the following morning, but the flames had charred it beyond recognition. The shoes, however, were untouched. In her agony, the dying girl had kicked them off. They were fairly new and of an uncommon design. With slow, patient work, the police traced them to the Parisian shop where they had been bought. The salesgirl remembered Dominique. Soon the police were interviewing Georges. He had an alibi. He had spent the night, he said, with his mistress, who supported this story. But in the bathroom, police found bullets of the same caliber as those that had killed the girl. Under slow and persistent questioning, Bill the Tough finally confessed to the murder of Dominique. He went further and confessed to another dozen gang killings. It seemed that he was determined to make his mark on the Paris underworld. In fact, no professional maquereau could ever have respect for a man who, in a burst of outraged self-esteem, had murdered a valuable property like Dominique. It seems doubtful whether there's any psychologist in the world who would be naive enough to suggest that Georges Rapin's shortcomings as a human being were due to his father's wealth. We've all met people like Georges Rapin. We all remember the boy at school who was always lying about his sexual experience or puffing a cigarette behind the lavatory. Georges Rapin was a born waster, and while a harsher environment might have saved him from life imprisonment, it would certainly have failed to turn him into a hard-working, serious member of the community. The psychological mainspring of the Georges Rapin type is a craving for self-esteem, combined with a lack of the qualities that would make him liked or respected. He spends all his time bidding for admiration with no intention of earning it, to borrow a phrase of Shaw's. Nero was the same. His intimates had to keep assuring him that he was the world's most talented poet, actor, singer, and wit. And although he was not a stupid man, the craving to be admired was so enormous that no flattery struck him as outrageous. We are here once again dealing with the problem of the violent man, so brilliantly described by A.E. Van Vogt, the man who will never, under any circumstances, admit that he might be in the wrong. The whole rickety structure of his self-esteem depends upon this belief. Such a man often treats his wife and family with incredible arrogance and brutality, if he suspects that they regard him as less than superhuman. On the other hand, Van Vogt points out that if his wife deserts him, he may become seriously ill or even commit suicide. She has proved to him that he is not a god. Georges Rapin's violence towards Dominique's threat of desertion suggests that he is a classic example of the right man. This is true of most of the cases of murderous millionaires, rich men who kill or hire someone to do the killing for them. The compulsion that drives them often leads to business success. Rapin might well have become a rich man in his own right if he hadn't committed murder. The success deepens the conviction that they are invincible, incapable of failure, and anyone who poses a threat to this insane self-admiration triggers an avalanche of murderous violence. For the same reason, any kind of threat to his fortune is likely to produce the same paranoid response. The case of Philip Stansfield provides an illustration. He was the son of Sir James Stansfield, a Scottish baronet of considerable wealth who owned a fine manor house near Dumfries. Descriptions of Philip's character suggest that he was of the same type as Georges Rapin, lazy, profligate and boastful. Finally, Sir James lost patience and threatened to disinherit him and to settle the estate on his younger brother. It was this threat that touched the deep spring of violence in Philip Stansfield. He had been looking forward to inheriting the estate, becoming lord of the manor and being able to do what he liked. In November 1687, Philip went home to the house at New Milns, perhaps hoping to persuade his father that he had mended his ways. But a clergyman called John Bell was staying there with his father, and Philip had a particular hatred of clergymen. On one occasion in church he had thrown a stone and hit the minister. The minister looked up and calmly prophesied that whoever had thrown the stone would have more people present at his death than were there in the church. On the night of November the 21st, he was in a particularly black mood when he went to bed. Sir James was nervous. He knew his son was capable of violence. In the middle of the night, the clergyman was awakened by loud voices and furious shouts. He later explained that he thought them to be evil spirits, and he bolted his door. The next morning, Philip Stansfield came to Bell's room and asked if he'd seen his father. The Reverend Bell said no, whereupon Philip went off saying that he was going to look for his father upon the banks of the water. Well, as this seemed a rather odd comment, the clergyman dressed and hastened downstairs and outside. There he met servants who told him that Sir James's body had just been found floating in a pond in the grounds. Philip had the body carried indoors, but to everyone's surprise, refused to let a doctor examine it. Instead, he went into mourning, and he ordered an early burial. The neighbours were understandably suspicious. Philip hinted that his father had committed suicide. The Reverend Bell told everybody that he talked with Sir James throughout the whole evening before his death, and that he had been perfectly cheerful and normal. Finally, an exhumation was ordered, and it was immediately clear that Sir James Stansfield had been throttled with considerable violence. And now a strange thing happened. Philip Stansfield was one of those who helped to lift his father's body out of its coffin and onto the autopsy bench. As soon as he touched it, the corpse began to bleed, so that Philip's hands were smeared with blood. The explanation may be simply that the body was scratched on some nail sticking up from the edge of the coffin, but in those days it was firmly believed that the corpse of a murdered person would bleed if the murderer touched it. Philip shouted, "Lord, help me!" and rushed out of the room, confirming the general suspicion. At this point, two children came forward with damning evidence. They lived in the cottage of a labourer named James Thompson, one of Sir James's servants. It's not clear from the evidence whether Thompson was their father or whether they were also servants lodging in the same cottage. They had heard Philip Stansfield, James Thompson, and a prostitute named Janet Johnston discussing in detail how Sir James could be killed. In the early hours of the morning, Thompson and Philip left. A long time later, Thompson returned alone. When his wife asked him where he had been, he said that the deed was done, and that they had thrown the body into the pond. It seems to have been Thompson who committed the actual murder while Philip stood guard outside the door. Philip was tried at Edinburgh and duly hanged, as well as having his hand cut off and his tongue cut out. Nearly two centuries later, another crime by a wealthy man touched the imagination of the British public. He was John Torwell, a middle-aged Quaker who had made his fortune in Australia. Torwell had been transported to Australia for forgery as a young man. Having served his sentence, he became a chemist in Sydney, and within a few years he was able to sell his business for £14,000. He invested this money in land and soon became a property millionaire. He also cornered the whalebone market. In those days, whalebone was in continual demand for corsets, combs and brushes, and when he returned to England, he was a very rich man. He had joined the Quakers and habitually wore the Quaker habit. He bought himself a large house in Berkhamsted, took a pretty servant girl named Sarah Hadler as a mistress, and all seemed to go well. But when Sarah became pregnant, he decided to install her elsewhere to avoid scandal. In 1845, she was living in a house in Salt Hill near Slough. She had a second child by Torwell, who visited her regularly and allowed her £1 a week. Then he decided to marry a local heiress named Miss Catford. Australia was going through a period of economic depression, and his income from his land had diminished. He was still rich, but the old neurotic insecurity of the right man suddenly gripped him. He felt that Sarah, whom he no longer loved, was an unnecessary drain on his income. In September 1843, after a visit from Torwell, she suddenly became ill and was sick for several days before recovering. On New Year's Day 1845, Torwell visited her again and sent her out for some stout. The two of them drank this, and then Sarah clutched at her stomach and began to groan and to roll on the floor. A next-door neighbour heard the noises and came out to see what was wrong. She saw Torwell fumbling nervously to unlatch the gate. He muttered something to her and rushed off down the road, and by the time the doctor arrived, Sarah was dead. Half an hour later, the Slough police dispatched a telegram to Paddington. A murder has just been committed at Salt Hill, and the suspected murderer was seen to take a first-class ticket for London by the train which left Slough at 7:42 p.m. The result was that when Torwell got off the train, he was followed by the police. The driver of the omnibus he took to a lodging house in the borough was a policeman in disguise. He denied having been in Slough, but his denial was hopeless. A post-mortem on Sarah Hadler revealed that she had died by poison, prussic acid. The chemist was found who had sold him the poison on the morning of the murder. The defence argued that Sarah could have died from eating too many apple pips. But the jury were unconvinced, and Torwell was hanged on March the 28th, 1845, after making a full confession to the murder. The case of John Torwell invites comparison with that of another murderous millionaire who made his fortune in Australia. Thomas Lay, who was at one time Minister of Justice in New South Wales. Lay's business methods had been dubious, and he had been suspected of disposing of at least one business rival. Back in England in the early 1930s, he became the lover of Mrs. Maggie Brooke, the wife of an ex-colleague, and although their sexual relations ceased after a few years, he continued to regard her with an insane jealousy. In 1946, he became convinced that Mrs. Brooke, now 66, was having a love affair with a young barman, John Muddy. In fact, she had only spoken to him once. On November the 28th, 1946, Muddy was lured to Lay's house in Beaufort Gardens in Kensington by a lady who believed that Muddy was a blackmailer and that Lay wanted to force him to leave the country. Muddy was overpowered, brutally beaten up by Lay, and then probably strangled by an accomplice, John Lawrence Smith, a builder's foreman hired by Lay. Lay and Smith then drove the corpse to a chalk pit near Woldingham in Surrey and dumped it there. It was found 2 days later. When Muddy was identified, the police discovered letters from Lay in his room. Lay and Smith stood trial together and were sentenced to death. However, Lay was found to be insane and died within 3 months of entering Broadmoor. Smith's sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. The conclusion, then, would seem to be that while most murderous millionaires are violent men, in Van Vogt's sense, few of them furnish evidence of the anarchist contention that it is their power that has corrupted them. Perhaps the last word should be left with Bernard Shaw, who wrote, "Power does not corrupt men. Fools, however, if they get into a position of power, corrupt power."